my internet. Okay. So we are recording whenever you want to introduce our guest. Dr. Bacard, you can. Can you hear us? Joe, can you hear us?
Okay. Hey. Hi, Tina.
Oh, there you are. Hey, thank you, sir. Okay. Appreciate it.
I think video is working. Sorry, my internet just went out 2 minutes ago. So
I know it's been a day. I think it's the wind here. It's super, super windy. So I'm not sure what the deal is. But thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm Dr. Tina Burton. I'm the associate dean. We've exchanged many emails. We have some folks here already. We probably will have more trickle in. It's still a little early for West Coast folks like myself. But I think we can get started. I did start the recording just so I didn't forget. And Dr. Bacard is here. So Dr. Bacard, would you like to introduce our guest speaker today?
Thank you, Dr. Burton. So I apologize. I'm not going to put my camera on. I'm not feeling very pitchy. I have kidney stones today. So sorry about that. So we are honored today to have General DiSalvo attend this event. So General, thank you for having for attending this event at my invitation. So this is a class that concentrates on cybersecurity, but I really want to have, I wanted to have you because we have a number of students that are current or former military, and I think they can appreciate your presence being here. You have quite a prestigious background. You were Lieutenant General in the U.S. Army. You a West Point grad. You have a master's in industrial engineering from the Air Force Institute of Technology. You've been a military officer with a large number of posts, and you have been on a number of boards recently after retiring. So, sir, thank you very much for accepting our invitation. And as discussed, would you like to start talking about leadership for the next few minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. And first, Dr. Burton, Dr. Bacard, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Hey, this is a real pleasure for me. I really enjoy interacting with students. So thank you for this opportunity. I prepared around 15 minutes of remarks centered on leadership, and then I'll proceed with obviously with questions and answers so we can talk national security challenges, what it's like with the interagency, any place you want to go with it. And frankly, I'm very comfortable with any question. And I assume this is all non-attributional. So I look forward to a good session. A quick background. So for the past 2 years, I've been working in an industry as a consultant, business development mainly. And prior to that, for 37 years, I was in the U.S. Army as a senior general officer. I also have a son who's in his senior year at the University of Texas. So like you, he's on final approach to joining the real world very soon. So what's the so what about this? I have recent experience in joining the civilian workforce, like you all are about to do, or some may already be in. And I'm also very sensitive to your generation's perspective on joining the workforce, based on what I see my son going through now, and the fact that I served with men and women from your generation in peace and combat, and understand the values, psyche, and goals. So all that said, I'll attempt to shape my comments accounting for your perspective. Now, first thing, I hate it when old folks complain about the current generation, snowflakes, everyone gets a trophy, blah, blah, blah. First of all, anyone doing that complaining normally help shape that same generation they're complaining about. So they really should be complaining about themselves. Second, from my perspective, I don't want the current generation of young adults to be like my generation. I want you all to be better than my generation, learn from what my generation got right, but more importantly, learn from what we got wrong. And regardless of what generation you are, I think resiliency is important. I also think mental fitness, physical fitness, spiritual fitness is critical to being resilient in good times and more importantly, in challenging times, which you're all going to be in. Second, never compromise your values. Once you have, it's almost impossible to regain honor, trust, and integrity. Your leadership is excellent at discerning good leadership from bad leadership. That said, don't wait for mentors to come to you. Seek out mentors that you see as setting an example that you want to emulate. and be yourself. Don't try to be someone you're not. I've seen many folks try and clone themselves into their mentor, and people will see right through that, and you'll come across as disingenuous. So not everyone is a mentor. Some are toxic leaders. What then? I'd say use this as an opportunity to remember what not to do when you're in a leadership position. Always remain professional with this person. Obviously, if egregious behavior is happening, like sexual harassment, bigotry, etc., report it as procedures call for and don't tolerate it. Watch your social media practices. The past can haunt you. And I know you've seen this, but just look at some of the executive branch's nominations as they go before committee. Some are hung up and probably won't get confirmed because of past tweets, posts, etc. So take pause, to make sure you're not doing a foot shot to your professional reputation. In today's information environment, although I'll call it more noise environment because vast majority is not information but opinion, my son reads something and will say, how did he or she act that way? They should have done A or B. Totally incompetent. And I always remind my son, there's probably more to the story than what he read. Number two, hindsight always makes things more simplistic than reality. And three, okay, remember your criticism and let's see how you do when you're in a similar position. You really need to, before reacting, hunt down what you've read and check the accuracy of it. Normally on a good day, I found 30% of what is reported on a good day is accurate. The other 70% is usually conjecture or opinion. Okay, switching gears a little. So what's the 22nd definition of a good leader? My view, a servant leader puts people above their own welfare, delegates responsibility, checks constructive criticism, accepts constructive criticism, is not afraid to make tough calls, leads by example, enforces high standards, and is committed to continuous learning and education, and does not have a zero defect mentality. Now, speaking of zero defects, although I said hopefully your boss will be tolerant of mistakes, the assumption is that there are not egregious mistakes like lying, cheating, etc. So assuming you do an honest mistake, and it will happen, fix it as soon as you realize what happened and let your boss, superior, whoever it is, know immediately. And then lastly, just try not to repeat it again. So if I was in your shoes about to go into the workforce today, here's some advice I'd offer. You only get one chance to make a good first impression. Be ready to articulate your value proposition in a two-minute encounter, like in an elevator, when you have that chance, that opportunity with a CEO, et cetera. And I'll just tell you, 6 months before my retirement from active duty, I blew it. I had the opportunity to be with a CEO from a major corporation. And basically he asked me, so what are your plans? That's his way of asking me, so what are you good at? And I totally blew it. So just remember, you had 2 minutes to make an impression. Don't blow it. Second, don't be afraid to ask basic questions. And my mantra is, there is no dumb question. The basic question you don't ask will then force you to make an assumption. And when the assumption is wrong, you'll make a mistake, but at least you know how to deal with it based on what I just told you. And as an example, I'm always wary of when people refer to they without specifics. And normally, if no name came up, they never existed. This also happens with words like transparent and seamless. Just beware, people throwing those words around like that are probably doing a big hand wave and are underwhelming something. Next, don't be afraid to take the initiative. Your radar should go on when you hear it's always been that way. Employers want to see folks take the initiative to improve performance, etc. And as an example, when I was a general officer, every month we had to submit a report, a very lengthy report on how ready my command was for whatever, peace, combat operations, et cetera. And nothing ever changed except it took an enormous amount of time. So finally, I asked the question, where does this monthly mandate come from? Why don't we do this quarterly? Because it's draining manpower, et cetera. And it turns out no one really knew. The assumption was made it was always a monthly report. So finally asking the question, where to come from. No one knew, and we were able to start doing it quarterly instead. Okay, next. It's easy when things are going well for everybody to be doing good. Your boss, though, is going to be watching you more closely when things are going bad. And as an example, when I had a command of a tank company, we were parked in the motor pool, and it's after a major exercise, and you have to clean the tanks and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, as we were cleaning, one of my sergeants had a tank round go off, ignite in the tank itself. That could have been disastrous. Fortunately, no one was killed. The inside of the tank was damaged pretty badly. But when everybody in descended upon me to, you know, basically ask what the hell is going on, how did this happen? Basically, I said, well, one issue that I've raised on several occasions, we don't have enough room to store equipment. We have to store it inside the tank. And when you traverse the tank to move to clean things out, it hit some gear that then caused a spark that then ignited the tank round. So I said, I've been asking for several months for separate conexes to store our stuff so that we can safely do maintenance and not have to worry about things inadvertently hitting something. And so after a month of investigations and all that, and all my friends thought I was history, that I get fired, the overall finding was this could have been prevented had we got storage areas to put our stuff and not keep the tank and the inside of the turret crowded. So what was a bad scene actually turned out to my advantage, because I simply told them the truth and how to remediate the situation. So you can make lemonade out of lemons, just you got to do it aggressively. Let me comment real quick on professionalism and education. I had the luxury of accessing various educational opportunities 9 times once I completed my undergraduate education at West Point. So over a 37-year career, you can do the math, that averages to almost once every 4 years during my military career of having some educational opportunity. Now, these opportunities, coupled with persistent professional reading, in my opinion, were invaluable and absolutely essential to being an effective leader and a professional. Regardless of which sector you may be headed, military, government, private industry, whatever, you have to embrace continuous learning in order to stay relevant and also to learn from history and not repeat the same mistakes. And then lastly, I'll talk about when you're in charge of a group project. It's a scenario I'm sure you've probably already experienced while in college, and inevitably you're gonna encounter this once you're in the workforce. First, don't be shy on taking charge. When in charge, take charge. Number two, be thick-skinned. Don't take comments, criticisms, other viewpoints personally. Three, put time and thought into identifying what exactly the purpose of your assignment, project, whatever it is. In other words, identify the problem and take time to identify the problem. And also clarify and find out what's the expected deliverable. And get confirmation from your boss or supervisor, whoever tasked you with this project. If this doesn't happen, I guarantee the herd you're leading will be grazing all over the plain in different directions, and you'll be chasing them all down. Also, keep track of every assumption that'll come in handy. As soon as feasible, delegate tasks and responsibilities to members of the group you're leading. Do not assume all this will happen automatically. The longer you delay doing this, the further your herd will continue to graze. So without being a tyrant, what leverage do you have over your peers as you lead this project? One, you have the attention of the person your team is working for, probably that boss or supervisor, and your team knows this. If someone is not pulling their weight, let them know. 99% of the time, the group leader is too shy to let the underperformer know. If they continue not to respond, then you can kick them off the team. Enforce milestones so everyone knows if the project is on time or falling behind schedule. Then give your boss periodic updates on the team's progress. So that's some of my thoughts on leadership and entering the workforce. And now I'd just like to field any comments, questions, and we can take this discussion any place you want.
Well, took a lot of notes of what you said. Do we have questions first from anybody so far? Okay, no questions written. So let me start asking you questions, if you don't mind. You mentioned be careful, you have 2 minutes, and then you can blow it. I could relate to that. It has happened to me a few times. But don't you think that you learn a lot by failure? It's something that I tell my students. Many students get very upset when I give them a bad grade. I mean, it happens to pretty much everyone. And I'm going to say almost, if it has never happened to you, you've not learned one of the critical things in education or in life, because at one point, you're going to fail. What are your thoughts on that?
No, absolutely, Dr. Picard. And I'll just tell you, there is no one on earth who has never failed to some extent. And I think the key again is learning from what caused the failure and then don't repeat it. And again, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. And this is also where you've got to be, again, I use the word thick-skinned on it. That's part of learning how to be resilient, how to rebound from a mishap or whatever. And quite honestly, I venture to guess Dr. Picard and Dr. Burton are the same. As long as your students are giving it their best effort, if they miss the mark, you can't give an A when it's not deserved. So you give what's appropriate. But what's more frustrating to people in a leadership position is when individuals aren't even trying and just underwhelmed and gave a less than complete effort. That part is inexcusable. So if you've given your best effort and you fell short and maybe got a C or D or something like that, okay, find out what went wrong and learn from it. But at least you can still look yourself in the mirror and know you gave it the best effort. I got to tell you, I thought I was going to be the world's best lawyer when I was at West Point, and I took a constitutional law course, and I thought I was just headed for the Supreme Court. I thought I could kick it. I was just doing great. I took the final, and I remember my professor, Major Meyer, used to be a nose tackle for Mississippi in his undergrad days, big hulking guy, looked at me and said, "Well, Mr. DeSalvo, let me tell you, I'd like to say you got to the 99-yard line and then fumbled, but you actually never made it past your own 20-yard line." And I was incredulous. And I said, "Sir, I gave it my best. I thought I studied for this. I gave it my best ever." He said, "Calm down. I know that. I'm just telling you, you missed the mark." He showed me what went wrong. And I got a D on a darn final. At least I passed the course. But he told me, I know it. You gave it your best effort. This is what, you know, you got, but now you know what to do next exam, and I'm sure you'll do fine. So that's just life. But you definitely have to learn from your mistakes, and they're going to happen.
And I think, thank you for saying that. I mean, I wish I could have you join in for the first seminars of every class to tell students failure is okay, because some students have problems with that. But I think you're absolutely right, yeah. Another thing, you said taking chances. Lots of people are very, very shy. One thing that intrigues me is that we have this wonderful tool for preparing for your next job, which is LinkedIn, and few people dare to take chances connecting to people, asking for recommendations, trying to get mentors. What word of advice would you give to a young professional trying to get into cybersecurity? What do you think is the value of LinkedIn?
Oh, well, first of all, cybersecurity is a great venue to get involved in. That's the hottest thing going on right now, as you all know. And it's something you can continue, I think, to have more of a demand. So networking. Yeah, take LinkedIn, for example. I think it's a great venue to network. And believe me, it's going to happen. I'll say this, though. You've got to, it's like fishing. If you just cast one line and wait the whole day, nothing's going to bite. You've got to cast a bazillion lines and you'll get a bite. I'll just give you an example. Again, when I started doing my transition 6 months out before my military retirement friend said, okay, you got to start networking. No one knows who the hell you are outside of DOD, et cetera. And so I thought I was doing good. I get on LinkedIn after I learned how to use it and started, you know, working the networking thing. And I thought, I'm sitting pretty good. I got 300 connections right now. Got a few bites, maybe five responses saying, yeah, call me when you're retired. We'll see what happens. So I went to a retirement seminar. And boy, that was a rude awakening. A guy told me, if you don't have 3,500 connections by now, you're not going to get anything. And he was dead on. And I'll just tell you. So I think I'm up to 4,500 connections. And five of these connections have led to something, which is great. And that's not unusual. So one, I guess you have nothing to lose by trying to expand your network. In fact, it's a necessity. Number two, and you've heard it, I'm sure, from Dr. Picard, even though you may join my network, I may not have a job offer for you, but I'm going to remember who you are. And then when I get awareness of somebody needing a skill set you have, I'll say, hey, John Jones or Jane Jones probably has a skill set. You want to look into it. And that's the beauty of it. That's how it works. Now, with that, you got to be smart on how you do your networking and get your name out there. And that's a whole different science. But it gets down to, again, that simple thing. What's your value proposition? You got to have that down pat. You've got to believe in it. And more importantly, you got to be able to back it up too. So when they want to deep dive, a potential employer or somebody wants to deep dive into what value you can bring to an organization, you've already got it thought out. You've got it written out. It's reflected in your CV or your resume or whatever. And that's where you're ready to launch. And this takes a lot of work, not to go off on a tangent, but your personal bio and also your cover letter and your resume, your CV, whatever, that takes a lot of work. And you've got the more people look at it, different people look at it and critique it, the tighter shot group you're going to get on it and the more effective it'll be. And you can't start that soon enough, even if you're not a senior. If you're a freshman, I don't know what the span is. You cannot start your resume soon enough to continue fine tuning it.
Thank you. There was a question from Ace. He's asking about, have you ever dealt with imposter syndrome? And if so, how did you handle it? That's an interesting question.
From imposter syndrome? So somebody pretending they're something they're not, you mean?
I guess. Ace, would you mind explaining what you have in mind, please? Do you have a microphone, Ace? Feel free to type otherwise. Feel free to type if you want.
Okay, and maybe if Ace's question was maybe how do you know if somebody's legit that may be, coming up on communications with you or trying to recruit you or something like that. I'll just say, normally say with LinkedIn, which I think is a pretty professional forum. Very rarely have I come across anybody that really is something they're not. Now, that said, you got to do due diligence, quite frankly. One, it always does good. It's always a good idea to do due diligence. One, it shows that prospective employer who's ever reaching out that you've done the homework, research, and put in the effort to find out more so that you can ask better questions of whatever they're trying to, you know, communicate with you. And number two, there are some folks out there, devious, you know, folks out there who may be trying to corral you into something that's a fraud or something. So you should have your radar up. Quite honestly, though, the good news is it doesn't happen that often, but just due diligence on anybody you're connecting with is always a good idea.
Yeah, I can tell you, actually, it was very interesting. At one point, I had a number of people from Iran that were trying to connect with me, and fortunately, I was paying attention, and I declined these. So be careful with those kind of things. Christina mentioned that it's people that don't deserve a position or feel they don't deserve it. So this is what Ace was talking about. Okay. Okay, you mentioned group projects taking charge. What would be your recommendation when there's two alpha people both competing for the same role?
Yeah, that's, in some aspects that can be sort of good rather than have no one wanting to take charge. And again, that hurt us all over the plane. I'd say this, if there's two alphas trying to take charge, well, one, hopefully that boss supervisor appointed one individual. If he did not, and it was sort of a natural selection to see who's there and you got two, then that's when hopefully the two folks get together and go to the supervisor to say, hey, who do you want in charge of this? And you really do need, you need to have one person in charge. Otherwise, folks are going to get confused. Now, if it's a case where one individual is designated to be in charge, yet the other person still wants to take charge, okay, that's where the one in charge gets with that other person. Hey, appreciate your energy, your effort, and you're wanting to do good. But this is the role you have based on the fact that, you know, I'm in a position to assign it to you, and we need to keep it that way. Otherwise, this group effort is going to get confused and crumble. And again, if that person doesn't want to back down, okay, you've afforded him, him or her that opportunity. Then you go to the boss and say, hey, this isn't working out. It's being counterproductive to this group project effort. And that's where that supervisor or boss or whoever can help straighten out. That can happen sort of, but generally, again, if the two people that get together and work it out, you can turn that into a positive thing.
Interesting answer. I wish it happened. it had happened always, as you said. I've had situations where managers would say, you know, figure it out, you know, find solutions yourselves. And yeah, it was kind of ugly at times. Okay. You mentioned people not pulling their weight. Don't you feel some now that in today's environment, people, especially HRs and managers, are kind of afraid to take some actions because of potential fear of something coming back? I was talking with a few individuals that are working in completely different fields, and they came up with comments that they prefer now to not do anything and, you know, leave the people more or less by themselves rather than kick them out because of fear of litigation, fear of bad press and things like that. So do you think it's really feasible in today's world, it's difficult to act like in the 80s where you would just say, okay, you're fired and, you know, you're gone. Is it still feasible to do that in today's world?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll just tell you that has been the biggest wake up for me from a military where in the military, human resource is really centered around individuals and setting them up for success, all that kind of stuff. Industry, civilian sector, geez, there are some where guidance from the board and from the C-suite is HR, keep the legal matters under control. Don't do anything that's going to upset the apple cart. Don't get employees mad so that they threaten lawsuits. And it's so risk adverse. But if that's the direction they're given, okay. But I think that's absolutely, one, idiotic. Number two, shows no spine for the organization on when it's time to take appropriate disciplinary type action that they don't want to. Maybe you can be successful in a corporation doing that, but I guarantee the morale of that workforce is going to be terrible. Their retention is probably going to be terrible. And eventually it's going to catch up with them for that. Again, I've seen instances of that going on, but quite frankly, it's unless you can get the senior leadership, like I said, CEO level, COO, and the board of directors to recognize that and rectify it, that organization is going to be doomed for failure, quite honestly. And if you're a victim of that, if you happen to be in the workforce and say you have a legitimate human resource type issue and nothing's being done. One, I went back down and they can always do that. Well, if you don't back down, we'll fire you or whatever. Still, this is where your own personal values never should be compromised. Don't back down. And quite frankly, if they're threatening to let go of you because you have a legitimate thing that they're too chicken to address, that organization probably isn't a good fit for you. And maybe it's better, you know, it's easy to say, leave a job when you don't have another one, maybe, or something. But that organization is destined for failure. And your professional development and career and aspirations are probably going to be cut off, plateaued, if you stay in that type of organization. So you would need to cut bait with it. And this sort of gets back to the due diligence. If somebody's offering you a position, make sure you do your research, ask all those type questions. And they may be tough questions, but if they can't answer them or don't want to answer them, that's a big signal for you, a big red flag, I would think, on do you really want to be part of that organization? But due diligence and ask around and find out the reputation and make sure that type of environment isn't happening, because that's a crusher without a doubt.
Thank you, sir. There was a question from Darwin that said, since you're no longer in the military, how have you addressed your interaction with management, getting them to understand why they need to change their current processes and policies, accept your ideas?
Yeah, first of all, the big thing is, and this will be simple, but make sure I'm using civilian terms that they understand and not coming across as, okay, here comes, you know, the former Patton who all he had to do was say, you know, do that and it was done. Well, this is different. I try and, one, debunk that myth big time, where, yes, I am experienced in working through issues with senior leadership, you know, organizations well above my level on what I think is right, you know, how well to advise them, et cetera, and just being quite candid with them on a very professional basis too. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm probably batting 300, which isn't bad, but 30% of the time they may take my advice, 70% noted, thank you, but we're still going to go in this thing. And that's fine, as long as it's nothing that I think is crossing the lines with values, ethics, or something like that. So that's where you got to take my own advice, be thick skinned, don't take rejection, you know, as a personal affront or whatever. But it is what it is. I'll tell you, interestingly, where I have not been able to connect, quite frankly, and this is no knock on higher education, but my dream job is to be a college president. And I've interviewed a few times on that. And I can just tell as soon as these initial interviews go, okay, this guy's military. He still thinks he can carry whatever made him successful in the military into, you know, higher education. And I'm a non-traditional type too. I do not have an academic background, so I'm fully sensitive to that. But trying to show folks, no, I can make the adjustment, and I know I'm not going to act like it's a military environment, which I'm well used to. That's a hard sell. And so you may find yourself in that position where, say, you want to go into the cyber field, and maybe you don't have a cyber background, but have that passion for it. Good on you, go for it. But you've got to constantly think, what messages can you use to resonate successfully with the cyber environment so that they, you know, want to hire you, whatever. And that's a challenge. And believe me, I'm not complaining about making that connection. It's a learning experience that all goes part of that professional development. Heck, I'm an old guy and I'm still learning new tricks and all that. I want to continue to learn tricks. And that's the way you've got to be, I think, to be successful and make those connections, which are hard.
Thank you, sir. There's a question from Daryl. Daryl used to be from the Marines, and he asked, can you describe the best trait you've brought with you from the military service, and likewise the trait that you had to fight the hardest to forget?
Boy, that's a great question, Daryl. Semper Fi, by the way, too. Yeah, this is going to sound weird. I think that the biggest trait, well, not weird, but it's basic, was one, trusting sources. In the military, when I get information, 90% of the time, okay, it was legit, and not 100% accurate or whatever, but at least I knew it was legit. The other 10%, it wasn't a lie, but it was just somebody making the wrong assessment, reading something wrong or whatever. In the civilian world, my gosh, the first 3 months after I retired, oh geez, I was so naive on how hard it is to get good information, valid information, et cetera. One, I was starving. I mean, geez, for 37 years, every day within the first 90 minutes I come to work, I'd have great read books set up, great intelligence, all that kind of stuff that you could digest and all that. Civilian world, that's been the biggest adjustment. There's stuff out there. The challenge is it information? Is it noise or is it opinion? Number two, how reliable is it? And how long is it reliable? In the civilian world, my gosh, stuff that's true one day can be false the next day or whatever. So just adjusting to information flow and accuracy and validity for me was the biggest challenge. And then secondly, and probably more importantly, was, okay, who's ever telling me this, did they do their due diligence? Is this actually researched, or is just their opinion, or did they scrape something together in 2 minutes to make it sound like it was, you know, something that they went into depth on? That's hard to discern. That was hard for me to discern. Quite frankly, still is. I've only been in this civilian thing for 2 years. And so I have to remind myself to, you know, make sure you pause and think when you're looking at something that's supposed to be information. I hope that helps, Daryl.
Thank you, sir. So what are your thoughts on cybersecurity? We mentioned at the beginning cybersecurity. Obviously, this is a class focusing on cybersecurity. What are your thoughts based on your experience on the field of cybersecurity?
Yeah, one, it's hugely dynamic. One, it's hugely important, as you all know, and it's very dynamic. So I would say if you want to go into that field, get your seatbelt on, because you may be going in one direction one day and the next day a completely different direction, which should be fun. I mean, you're not going to get bored. Number two, there is no shortage of demand for cybersecurity specialists. And I think the key is identifying what specialty within cyber domain you want to go into. I mean, there's tons. Artificial intelligence is huge right now. And I mean, that's all over the map, sort of. Obviously, cybersecurity is huge. Cyber practices. I could go on and on. So again, there's plenty of disciplines, and they continue to multiply exponentially too. So they're probably going to be looking for a best athlete type decathlete with cyber world. Not only are you good in one aspect, say in programming, but then also say a little bit of artificial intelligence, open architecture, knowing how to do that, et cetera. And I'm sort of, believe me, I'm not a technical person, but I'm just thinking about some clients I have in the cyber world on what type of talent they're working for. I think the other thing too is, along with being flexible, the standards are changing almost daily. And so don't get frustrated with, you might be working with a company and you're the cyber person, and they say, okay, make sure that we are in compliance with federal and state regulations. Just by the time you get your organization that way and give the thumbs up to the boss, that standard may have changed. And it's going to, it's got to, because you can never be secure enough from a cyber point of view. And you all know the threats to cyber continue to increase too, and the vulnerabilities, et cetera. So just, you've got to be ready to be very flexible, be agile in how you adjust on it or whatever. But I think it's a great field to be in. And again, there is a huge calling for talent in that. So I don't think you'll have a problem finding a job if you're into the cyber world right now. And that also, not only with big industry, but within niche industries too, which are really coming on board. It could be a small tech company. They're going to need it. And man, if you can latch into something like that, that's really cool, because you'll be able to make a huge impact in a small organization that's going to put them on a path to grow.
You mentioned the words agile, which is a big interest of mine. I actually did part of my doctorate on agile. What are your thoughts on agile?
Geez, from being agile intellectually, mentally, and also professionally, where if you can prove to somebody that you're more than a one-trick pony, that even though this is your field of expertise, you can go left or right and deviate when needed and be value added. That is absolutely huge. And I think the best way to attain agility is, one, don't be afraid to be agile. And that sort of goes with being innovative. You can't be afraid to get outside your comfort zone or to pursue a good idea that no one's thought of. So innovation is part of being agile. Number two, the way you get to be agile is, again, that continuing education and professional development, where you're constantly on your radar looking left and right to see, boy, that's interesting. I wonder how that came about, getting smart on that. And that will probably light something in you that says, geez, I think I could take this a step further or whatever. So that continuing education, professional development, and that aggressiveness to be innovative, I think are key characteristics of being agile, which any employer is going to love in an employee, I guarantee it.
Thank you. Let me look if there's any other questions that we missed so far. Dr. Burton, did you see any questions that I missed so far?
Only two. I think there were more comments than another question. There's a new one that just popped up, though. Is there a way to get into DoD contracting? Is Darwin's question. If you don't have a military background, is it still possible to get the current clearances and all that to get into DoD contracting?
Sure, absolutely. And boy, if you want to get in DoD contracting, that's a great thing and a very complicated and frustrating and needs world of improvement as far as I'm concerned. The good news is you probably hear about innovation and especially within the Department of Defense, they have the Defense Innovation Unit. So how can Department of Defense get quicker access to technology just like the commercial sector can do? So that we keep ahead of our adversaries, et cetera. A key aspect of that is actually contracting, getting smart on how to work through federal contracting regulations and how to change them so that you're not handcuffed, which we are right now, DoD is, with a system that Robert McNamara started in 1965 that we still use, which is still too cumbersome. So the good news is there's recognition that needs to change. There's good news, too, that they're looking for folks who are interested in contract management, et cetera, who can bring new ideas into the field. And quite frankly, there's internships that you can pursue within DoD to get familiar with what the challenge is and also get your name out there to join the workforce on that. And so I would look into those internships on DoD, and you just go on any DoD website that shows internships out there. They're there. And also go on LinkedIn and look for those who are in DoD contracting, and they will steer you in the right direction without a doubt. But if you're great with accounting, if you're an accountant major, let's say, or a business major, doesn't matter, or whatever, that field is wide open for young talent right now. So strongly recommend it. The other thing I recommend is there's, again, Defense Innovation Unit, and there's a website for them under DoD. Look at that, and you can get your name out there saying, hey, I'd love to get involved with contracting. It can expedite new technology and speed up innovation within DoD. You'll probably get a response, I'm pretty sure.
To emphasize on what you just said, a website would be usajobs.gov. Which would be one of the main sites which publicize internships and regular jobs for anyone looking. If I may, one comment that I would say is that the problem with contracting is that, in DoD terms, which I'm very familiar with, is that CDRLs, the contractual delivery requirement list, whatever it is, the language is you shall do this, you shall do that. And as a result, it leaves no opportunity for anything else. And the problem is that if you use a framework that is proven to work in small projects, such as Agile. Agile works really well in short projects, meaning under a year, 10 people or less, under $1 million. Those projects work really, really well with Agile. But the problem is that you do not know what you're going to deliver, because an Agile team is self-empowering. Means that you remove all of the middle management. You give a priority of things that need to be done, but let's say you're trying to build a plane and you may end up building an hydroplane because the team finds out that this is really what should be built. But in terms of contracting, the problem is that if you have lawyers, the lawyers are going to say, we ask you to build a plane, you build an hydrofoil, you have not delivered. So this would require a complete change, in my opinion, in legal, because attorneys could not get involved with this piece, because the development team needs to be able to make decisions on the spot. The time frames in Agile are 2 weeks, typically. So you need to have for each iteration very, very quick decisions, which means that someone in DoD is going to need to be able to make contractual decisions on behalf of a program. And I'm sure you know as well as I do, sir, that an O1 or O2 is not going to be allowed to make decisions on behalf of a general officer or even an O6. So it would require empowering people in a way that that is very unusual. So I personally don't see it happening unless it's a special program of some sort that is chaperoned by someone willing to take risk. But I don't see, with the current mindset of contracts, this happening, unfortunately. So I hope you don't mind me commenting, but this is my personal experience. I'm sure Daryl could comment on this. Daryl, do you want to say something about this, since I know you have plenty of experience on this?
Oh, the DoD is a challenging environment. It's a big, heavy ship to steer. It'll definitely take a major climate change, but hopefully they do something, because it absolutely has to change.
Yeah, and I think you all bring up a great point. And I will say this, though. I think there is some glimmer of hope with the fact that over the last 3 years, some smart person finally said, how the hell did we get to the moon? You know, initially back in, you know, the program started in the 60s. And I mean, you look at the time frame NASA had to, no kidding, take President Kennedy's mandate and get to the moon in 69 there. They had to throw out of the window all the red tape involved and figure out how to get new technology sooner rather than later and bypass all those frustrating steps, you know, and levels of approval, you know, to make a darn lunar module, et cetera. The good news is DoD recognized that 5 years ago. And so they have rejuvenated the same contract authorities that expedited contracting for NASA back in 1965 or whatever. They've rejuvenated some of those now. There's still a lot of institutional friction to overcome on, well, we never did it that way before, some of that stuff I mentioned earlier. And there's some, you know, insurgents, as I call them, within the contracting community who won't budge. No, we're going to go lockstep and all that. All those frustrations that Daryl and Dr. Picard talked about, there is starting to get some groundswell to, you know, cut it out. Let's get back to how can we rapidly prototype new technology and get it into the mainstream for programs of record. And if you look at Army Futures Command, just go ahead and do some research on it. You'll see there how they're trying to pursue that avenue. And it's shown some promise. We're not even at the 50-yard line, I don't think, but at least there's more general recognition on old ways of doing business and contracting are not going to get us to where we need to be. So I agree 100% with what you two said.
It's funny that you mentioned the moon. We had a few weeks ago, we had Joe Justice, Dr. Burton, you may remember. Joe Justice mentioned that he worked with the DOD on some programs that he was not allowed to discuss. But he also mentioned that he worked on SpaceX, right? And he mentioned that in SpaceX, they deliver one spaceship per week. This is their mandate. They accept that they're going to trash 80% of the deliverables with an idea to keep having constant iterations to improve continuously. I hope that we come to this kind of mindset in the DoD to produce whatever the warfighter needs as opposed to produce paperwork. And if we go back to cybersecurity, the risk management framework, for example, in cybersecurity has created, in my opinion, one of those crazy situations where we do more compliance as opposed to protecting the crown jewels of an organization. Risk management should be about, trying to look at what we're doing, what are the risks, how do we protect against those things. And right now, cybersecurity is more about doing checklists and making sure that, all of the dots are crossed. And we're not there yet. I mean, I wish someone was able to go and explain these to leadership, but maybe some other day will happen. Okay. Any other questions, anyone? So far, questions?
I think what you mentioned, Dr. Bouchard, makes me think that that's a big distinction between government service and the corporate world, right? I mean, obviously, the agendas are different. Even if a private company was trying to go to the moon versus the government trying to go to the moon, the approach would have to be different, right? Because of the responsibility that the government agency has that maybe the corporation doesn't. The corporation has a responsibility to stockholders possibly, and then their CEO, but they could fold and go under and be fine. If the DOD or if the government makes a decision and a mistake for the entire country, then there's a little bit more of a, problem. So I think that's where the line probably gets drawn. And I mean, I think it's exciting on one hand to be able to work for a government agency that has all the power to do anything that needs to be done and certainly enough funding to be able to do it. But the downside of that is they have to be so overly cautious that it's kind of a snail as far as snail space, as far as how we can get. Whereas, Tesla or somebody else, can throw all the money they need at it to make it great. And they don't have to be responsible for the entire, nation. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. If you had to choose now for your career, would you have done the military line or would you have done the corporate line? Do you know now if you would recommend one direction versus the other as far as your career?
Oh, I'd still, I'm very biased. I still do the military thing without a doubt.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, right? And I mean, clearly you've had a great experience and, prospered because of your experience. But I'm just wondering, looking back, would it have been a completely different life experience in industry if you hadn't gone the military track?
Right. And, Dr. Byrne, you bring a great point where, so SpaceX, and the buzzword within DOD right now is you can't be afraid to fail. And this drives me nuts. They're throwing that word around like, yeah, you're right. And it's true. SpaceX, they do. They have the robust funding and funding mechanisms to be able to afford to fail. Because you get it right once and you'll make up for all the failures and all that. And that's that venture capitalist attitude, which works great in industry, and that'll help us within DOD. However, when you're within DOD, hell, we can afford to fail. That's just counterintuitive to any of our psyche. Now, I got it for program development, whatever, but it still is tied to potentially life and death. So you want to make sure you get it right. Number two, the beauty of SpaceX and industry is they have their experts who are part of that team the whole way from inception to birthing to then crawling, walking, running, et cetera. And I mean, look at it. Musk has been doing his stuff now for over 25 years. This stuff just didn't happen overnight. In the military, you do have the civilian workforce, but a lot of the leadership is going to be military folks. They're only going to be with a program for 4 years, if that. And then they got to go on to something else. And especially at the colonel level, where it's the program managers, which are absolutely key, that is their command equivalent assignment. They're there for 3 years. And do you think on their, we call it a support form, so what did you do for your country when it's time to get evaluated? They're going to say, it was great. We tried these three things and we failed fast, but we're okay. That'll never go over. It's not the mindset. So this thing about DOD needs to adopt a fail fast attitude, sort of, but not the way civilian industry can do. I think the best recommendation I've heard is industry telling DOD, tell us what the characteristics you want for whatever it is. Don't tell us the requirements. Because when you get into requirements, now you're going to go down the road that Dr. Picard talked about. Did you meet it or not? Then you get into the legal stuff, legal contract stuff. Did they meet the all this kind of stuff? And now you get bogged down into acquisition regulations that'll slow a project and bring it to its knees. So maybe just this subtle shift into, hey, industry, these are characteristics we're looking for in a tank, in a helicopter, whatever. Then let industry come back and say, okay, you know, we probably got something for this. And now you've got something at least technically feasible that won't be, you know, impossible because they didn't meet every requirement that was dictated. So maybe that mindset adjustment, attitude adjustment will help rectify, you know, the problems that we're having. I hope it does.
Yeah. The interesting thing that you said that resonated with me that I've never really thought about, because I came from a military family too. My father was, you know, for 20 years. And I kind of always assumed, and it's a stupid assumption, that people go into the military and they stay. But you kind of mentioned that they're really a transitional workforce. It would be like having a corporation where you have new employees every 4 years, right? Like you said, not all of them stay. So I don't know what percentage that is, but that definitely makes a very different dynamic, right? Over time, that you would constantly have new folks coming in, which is a good thing and a bad thing, right? So I never thought about it that way, that the military is kind of an influx of people coming and going rather than, you know, a stable environment like a corporation might be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And same for the civilian leadership. SecDef is going to switch out, you know, probably at least once every 4 years or whatever. National security strategy, it's by law, it's supposed to come out once every 4 years. So, you know, SpaceX, et cetera, they've had the luxury of a strategic vision strategy that the leadership is focused on. It is not subject to change. Whereas DOD, it's nature of the government. It's hard to get a strategy that everybody signs up for when it transcends administrations, transcends department heads, et cetera. It's a very hard thing to do. Yeah. So another complicating factor.
No, that's a big point. I mean, obviously every time we get a new president and a new administration, it's just kind of like getting a new CEO at your corporation. It would probably be kind of disruptive. Just saying, just a little bit, but that's awesome. Yeah. I never really thought about it that way.
Yeah,
but I know we have a time.
Yeah. And as we're working, dealing with this, I can tell you that it's very, very disruptive to work with officers and enlisted who keep changing all the time. You spend months training them, and by the time they start to understand what it's all about, they're pretty much gone. So it's very, it's very, very difficult and challenging at times. There is, if I may, an interesting question from Darwin. Darwin states at the start of the presentation, you mentioned the younger generation should learn from the older generation. I guess that's me, right? What is your opinion on how it seems they are currently bent on erasing the past? Parentheses, tearing down monuments and changing the name of public buildings. If you're comfortable answering this. This is a good point, if you're comfortable answering this.
That's a very good question. So with the, the council culture thing that seems to be, raising its head and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what the right answer is. I'll say this, you can't erase the past, and you can certainly learn from the past. And this is why I said you've got to, history reading is so darn important, et cetera, so that you know what went right and what went wrong. And although some are giving this narrative now that the bad things that happened in our past, racial injustice, et cetera, we should just eliminate it completely and all that kind of stuff. One, you can't eliminate it. There's already enough, material out there. Material can either be monuments, it can be institutions, it can be books, whatever, that are going to transcend time. Now, it's important to understand what lessons can be learned from those, from all those different entities, as I'll call them, I think. But this, I don't know, that's a tough one. And simply just saying this was terrible, so we need to obliterate it completely. I agree, you don't want to repeat the same mistake, but you've got to still know what went on so it won't raise its ugly head again, 55 years from now on it. Now, the other thing too, so the new generation learning from the older generation, like my, I guess, or whatever, it's two-way street. I say again, we can be learning a lot from that younger generation that's got new ideas, innovative ideas, etc. And I tell you where I learned this a lot from is my both son-in-laws have been doing the telecommunicating, and of course COVID really made that happen big time. You had no choice. But even before that, they would tell me, I don't know why I need to go into the office when I can do my stuff from here. We've got the right technology. It saves a lot of maintenance, office, all this kind of stuff. And boy, I was thinking, I could never do that. I've got to have the personal contact, et cetera, et cetera. But geez, they've nailed it. They have not missed a step since COVID because they are already geared up for that. And this is what I love about the younger generation. And I've lost track, Gen Zers, millennials or whatever. I've worked with five different ones, so, and I love them all. So I don't, they're just great. But this generation, I think these younger ones are very innovative, very flexible, mentally flexible, and can adapt very easily. And that's something I think we should all embrace and learn how that's done, especially the older you are. Maybe we can learn something from them on how to adapt. Look at the generations under COVID for 2 years now, ongoing almost 2 years, have managed to be resilient when they couldn't get together, couldn't enjoy, social events, sports, you name it, whatever, having to do it isolated. And I'm looking at them, I'm thinking, my gosh, they have showed some amazing resiliency and how to adapt. So I think the way they've done this, the way you all have done this, as you go into your professional lives, you'll be throwing curveballs that I never saw that I think you're going to have the tool set to adjust to, just because resiliency and adaptation is a trait that your generation has that quite frankly, I don't think mine had enough of.
I can certainly speak to that. It's hard to be flexible physically or mentally at this age. It comes much more naturally when you're younger. Well, I think this was very interesting. I think very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Picard, for bringing our speaker to us. And thank you for coming, General Dr. Picard.
Thank you, sir, for for spending the time today with us. It is much appreciated. Thank you very much. Dr. Burson, back to you.
Yeah, and just so you know, I think I told you up front, but in case you forgot, that we're going to convert this into a podcast, and it will be published on our website. So I'll send you that link later if you want to share that. And for anyone that missed the beginning of this, the webinar will be available at that point. And we very much appreciate your time today. I think it was awesome. Very fun.
Thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And again, I wish everybody the best of luck. I have no doubt you're gonna do great. And it's really a pleasure talking to you. And I really enjoyed it. So thank you very much, Dr. Burton, Dr. Picard. And I wish you all the best. God bless you all.
Awesome. Have a good week, folks. Thank you. Bye.